啊？
I was going to say I'm glad to be here. That's crap. I want to thank you all for inviting me, Shannon. I really am glad to be here. It's been fun. It's been a good time. I'm Gary Brown. I'm an alcoholic. My dry date's the third day of December, 1964. And anymore when I say that, it feels like I'm bragging. I am bragging. And a few weeks ago, Shannon called and asked the name of my home group. And I told her that it was the Dignitaries Sympathy Group. And I spelled it for her. But it spells the Dignitaties Sympathy Group. Oh, okay. I'd rather blame Shannon. We are a group in Indianapolis. It's a closed discussion meeting, and we average about 50 men there. Our group conscience is very much be that it's a stag meeting, and there are a few of us there that every time we have a group conscious meeting, we try to change that, but we get beat down every time. And it's not necessarily by a vote, it's by a group conscience. And I'll just share that with you a little bit. I want you to know we're a real AA group, so I'm trying to say. This came up a couple of years ago again, that we were going to open it up to the other half of the fellowship. And there was a real beef going on. I mean, there were some of the men there that absolutely did not want that. They said, we come to this meeting because we're more honest here. We're not sitting around to make ourselves look good in front of the girls. And we think we've learned more here. We don't want to change it. And other ones wanted to stick with the traditions and be the way it was. And it got pretty heated. And they just weren't getting anywhere. And the chairperson of that group, Robbie, saw that. And he said, why don't we go to lunch, come back in a couple hours, but let's pray before we go. And they didn't know any other prayer, so they said the Lord's Prayer and they left. And when they came back, the energy was gone, the mad was gone. And they looked around the group and they got to thinking that the girls they really wanted to attend the meeting anyway probably weren't going to get dressed and come down and play in the treehouse with us as it was. And they got up and went home. And I like to tell that story because there wasn't a vote. It was a group conscience. And that's the way it was. And I really think that's important to say because so often we've lost the conscience when we vote. A fellow in the group last Tuesday night described it. We had some other people come down there from the other side of town that they wanted to check us out. People hear about us because we're generally a little noisy about talking about our experience with the book and the steps. And they come down to kind of size us up. And one of us there was describing the Dignitary Sympathy Group as a remedial group. That's really important. We are a remedial group. That's not graduate AA. We're there for the guys that just can't get it anywhere else. And so far, so good. Had no intentions of saying all. I don't know where it came from. I was trying to grow up on this experimental farm outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming. I wasn't the experiment. And I was out in the country there, and I loved it out there. It was fun growing up out there because I could do the things I thought real men did. I had a gun, and I'd go out and shoot jackrabbits, and I could be by myself easily, and I could grab a tent and go camp in the woods. And I'd watch the men that worked out there, and they looked like my kind of guys. You know, they were hardworking men, and when they went to town on Saturday night, they were hard-drinking men. And whatever happened that night, they came back and they made it back to work. And I really wanted to be like them. You know, some of them went to church. I even wanted to be like them, though I didn't know what they were doing there. But something as a child, when I saw that, made me think that I was never going to cut it. I wasn't going to be like them. And I had that fear going on way back then. I was fascinated by booze. I watched what happened when my dad and those guys drank. Because my dad became fun. Brendan, my dad was 5'6" tall. Weighed about 120 pounds soaking wet. And had a small man's attitude. He was ticked off about all the time. But when he drank, he would change and he'd be fun. And I knew there was something magic in booze. And I knew that very, very early. Because I'd watched that happen. And so I was fascinated by booze because I watched what it did with these other guys. And as a youngster growing up, I was bound determined to try it out. And so I broke into the neighbor's house because they had a pantry that was full of different kinds of bottles of liquor. Incidentally, I made it a goal to have a pantry just like that one when I grew up. But I couldn't get them in there fast enough. It didn't keep. First time I got a hold of enough, I was a sophomore in high school. I was riding over from Cheyenne to Laramie, Wyoming. It's about a 60-mile ride, and we were going over to the state basketball tournament, two other fellows and myself. And we were driven over there, and we got there, and we decided we needed something to drink. So it's a 21-year, you had to be 21 to drink in Wyoming. So we found some guy to buy us a bottle of Four Roses, and we found a couple of girls that kind of wanted to go with us for some reason. I look back on that situation a number of years later, and I got to think about it because we didn't know what to do with the booze or the girls. Couldn't go to the drugstore and buy the magazines that you can now that explain it all. And so we went out on a place called the 9th Street Hill. It's just the boondocks. We popped the top. We'd bought some Coke to go with that. That's Coca-Cola. Just got to explain all that anymore. We popped the top of that bottle and we wiped it off and we passed it around. I did it like I'd seen the cowboys do it that first time around. Then the second time it came around, I tipped it up and I drank all I could get till they took it away from me. And I got a bunch of whiskey. And I'd gotten in that car earlier that day with the same feeling I'd had all my life that I really didn't belong with that bunch. And I'd felt that way like we all have in school or wherever I was. I was the guy that felt like I had the wart right here in the end of my nose. Nobody else could see it but me, but that's what I felt like. And got that whiskey in me and everything changed. It just changed. I no longer felt like I didn't belong with that group in that car. Hell, I felt like I owned that group in that car. And it was wonderful and it was great. I made a pass at one of the girls, and she slapped me around a little bit, and it was pretty clumsy, but I did my best. A little while later, they're going to sober me up, so they took me to the truck stop to fill me full of coffee, and it didn't sober me up, but it woke me up. And I took a poke at a big cowboy, Kurt, and he did beat the shit out of me. It was just the way it was. And they took me wherever we were staying and tucked me in. And I like telling that story because I could tell you all the rest of my drinking and nothing's going to change. That was as successful as I ever got as a social drinker. And it just was. Any other attempts at it were complete failures. And I always embarrassed Julie and the kids. I met Julie in high school. She picked me up someplace. I don't remember just where it was, but... I was telling Shannon, she says, you guys have been married for 46 years. I said, no, she's had it made for 46 years. But she is my childhood bride, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I effectively, we got married. I was, I'd been in the Army a short time, 6 months in a court martial, and I came home this one day, and Julia was a year behind me in high school, and so that day I called the high school and I said, "I'm Julie Bailey's dad. And we have an emergency coming up, and I'd like to come by and pick her up at the north door of the school if I could." And she just come out there bigger than life, and we just kind of took off. And I don't remember all the details, but I can tell you later on that year we got married. And a few months later we had a 8.5-pound premature baby girl, and. I used to tell that story, and she'd be sitting down there, and her lips would say, "You son of a bitch." I said it these days, and people don't even laugh. Yeah, so what? And and we had a short period of time, we had three young ladies. I'm going to tell you more about them right now. Not right now, but a little later on. But we had the girls quickly. I had a ton of jobs quickly. And by the time I was 24 years, a month before my 25th birthday, I'd pretty well lost everything we could potentially get, though I hadn't accumulated much. And I was truly dying of alcoholism. I had been asked to leave the house, and so I moved in with the Ham's beer distributor. I thought it was a remarkable move myself. A couple days later, he didn't think it was so damn slick, and so I was looking for a place again, and. I thought I'd been doing a little drinking and playing liar's poker, and I'd bought back some bad checks, and I was wondering what I was going to do next, and I decided I'd see if I could get back in the house. And I called Julie, and I told her I'd like to see the kids. And she said, "Come on by," and I thought she went for it. And I go to the house, and her dad was there. We had that talk, Jack. You remember that talk? Yeah, yeah, and I can't tell the details, and I'm not sure she can either because they're substantially different than mine. But it had to do with what they were going to do with Gary. And the only thing they knew to do with Gary at that point in time was to, well, there's this nut house at the other end of the state. Cheyenne's in the southeast corner of the state, and Evanston, Wyoming, 400 miles away is, had this nut house there, and the only thing they knew to do was send me there, because that's what they'd done with all the other drunks in the family, mainly Uncle Bert, who incidentally died in the pickup truck on his last ride going up there. But he hadn't done that yet, and so I looked at Julie's dad, and I said, "Well, I'll go there if you'll give me a ride up there. What the hell, it's only 400 miles. And he said, "No, I won't do that, but I'll take you down to the bus station." And that's how I got there. I rode the bus. And I got in there, and things did begin for me at that point. What I haven't talked about is what was going on in here during those years. And I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't numb. I wasn't anesthetized. It took a lot of stuff to get away from the hole in my belly with the wind blowing through it. It took a lot of it. It took a lot of lying and cheating and stealing and that stuff that just made me feel worse and worse and worse. It took me smacking Julia around in the kitchen one time. It took me just doing all that stuff that always makes you just feel like a real he-man. There's not enough liquor to take that away. It doesn't happen that way. And so I guess what I'm telling you is at that point in my life, and I've been there since sober in that point in my life, where the pain was so bad I would do anything to get away from it, to get away with it. I'd become everything I despised. There wasn't a thing about me that I was worth the, thought was worth the powder to blow up. And so I took a long bus ride there, and going to flash ahead real quick. A few years later, after I'd been sober for a while, Julie and the girls and I were at her parents' house eating Thanksgiving dinner. And her dad looked at me and he says, "Gary, do you remember the day you went up to the nut house?" I said, I said, "Sure, why?" He says, "You know, I didn't much care which bus you got on." Just as long as it's leaving Cheyenne. Cop took me to the door after I got to the bus. I still don't know how he knew. And the process went kind of down. They kept me in there for 16 weeks. And that was their normal time. That that was their 30-day spin dry. Only it took 16 weeks. And what I learned, what happened to me in there were several things. And I'll just tell you about them real briefly here. I went in there. I was 6 foot 2 inches tall. I weighed something less than 127 pounds. I'd been fighting and drinking and forgotten to eat. And I'd taken some pretty brutal beatings. And I was a fighter. I just wasn't a winner. And they locked me up in a room that had one little window in the door, and every once in a while I'd look up and they'd be looking back in me, at me, and I didn't mind it a bit. I thought that's just fine. Maybe they can't get in here. I didn't mind being locked in at all. Somebody else talked about that. I guess it was you, wasn't it, Luther? Yeah. I got to tell, for those of you that didn't hear Luther this afternoon, that was delightful. Except for the part where he talked about being the straight-A student. Kind of ticked me off. By the time I was a senior in high school, my dad had told me, he said, "Gary, you're going to graduate from high school. I'll guarantee you, you're going to graduate. If we got to move to town so you don't have so far to walk when you get old, you're going to graduate from high school." I graduated from high school with a D minus. Worked hard for it. And I'm locked in that nut house, and after a while they kicked me out and put me on the alcoholic ward, and I was, like I said, I was 24, approaching 25 years old, and by far the youngest person there. By far. I mean, these guys were all much older than me, and it really didn't make a too big a difference for me, except one day when I'd been there for a few weeks, and we're all downstairs sitting around one of these round tables about like that, drinking coffee, and they're talking about what they're going to do when they get out. One of them's going to go get the ranch back. He's going to go back to Fort Bridger and get the ranch back and get that taken. Another one's going to go back to Casper and see if he can get back in the oil business. And another one's going to go get family. Another one's going to build his business back and all that. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to all this stuff. And I'm thinking, my God, I'm in a room full of has-beens. That struck me, I'm a never was. It became my turn to talk. And I'm looking at them, and they're just staring at me. And I said, "You know, I don't have any idea what I'm going to do. I don't have a clue. All I know is I never want to take another drink again." And I'd never had that thought in my life. I guarantee it was novel. I'd never thought that till I heard myself say it. And I knew it was true. Qualified me to be an AA right there, huh? Know that either. And they brought AA in there, and I'll tell you briefly how that went. They would file us down to where the AA group met. We could stand by the barred windows and watch the cars come in as they drove up from Salt Lake City or the town of Evanston or down from Green River. And they would drive in there, and I'd sit there and I'd look at the cars, and I didn't see an alcoholic in the bunch of them. These cars had chrome strips on both sides. Both headlights. One-piece windshield. And when they came in, they talked about things I couldn't possibly imagine. They talked about God. And I hadn't had many conversations about God. My parents had nothing to do with Him particularly. I learned the Lord's Prayer in AA meetings. I truly didn't know it. With that, so it was very uncomfortable for me. It didn't irritate me. I wasn't mad. I didn't feel like I'd been let down by any believers. There'd been a few down the road at the experimental farm where I grew up on that went to church every Sunday, and they wouldn't let their kids play with me, but I... Didn't everybody smoke by the time they were 10? I didn't. So I watched what was going on in AA, and I learned just enough to pick up on some things. I picked up on the idea that I probably won't stay sober if I don't hang around people like those that came in there. I was pretty well sure I was going to have to go to AA. Wasn't my first choice in life. Wasn't my third choice in life. But I knew that. And I don't know as I knew much more. Back to the family. That oldest girl I told you about, she had her fourth birthday, I think? Her fourth birthday. Her birthday present was to ride a train up to the Nut House to see her dad. Julie told me she liked to sit in the bathroom because she could look down and see the ground going underneath through the toilet. And chip off the old block. It came to me. I got my physical health back. I guess that's important. I ought to tell that. Here, I learned about AA. I got my health back. I learned to eat there. I literally had to learn to eat. I was that sick. I just hadn't been eating. It wasn't necessary, you know. They would bring in whole meals, you know, meat, potatoes, gravy, and all of that. And I really couldn't do it. I had to learn to do it. And I caught on that AA probably meant I was going to survive. And time came close, and I knew I was going to get to go back to Cheyenne. And they came to me and they said, "Gary, we got something for you if you want it." They said, "If you would like to, we got this deal here where we'll send you to college, buy all your books and tuition, and give you enough money to maintain your wife and children while you're doing it. What do you think you'd like to do?" And they're asking that to a man whose only alternative is to go out and find a job. You know, that's an easy decision. And so that's what happened. We got back there. Julie had been living with some relatives of mine a few miles south. But I got back there, and a cop met me when I got off the bus. And I don't think of this story often. I've had that experience going on. His name was Lloyd Gallion, and Lloyd was there for me when I got off the bus. And I don't think anybody sent him. Are you aware of anybody that did that? And all that, and he says, "Yeah." He says, "I knew you were getting here." He says, "There are just some of us that really ought not drink." So those were exact words. And that's all he said to me. He took us out to Julie's folks' house. He took me out there and dropped me off. I got my first memory of my youngest daughter there. At that point, she had been born August 31st that year. And so she was, 5 months old. And I had no memories of her. I knew she was there because we talked about her, but... That was my first sight of my youngest daughter. Next morning, there's a knock on my door, and this guy comes to the door, and he says, my name's Jim, and he said, what are you doing tonight? And I said, well, I don't think I'm doing anything. And he says, good, we'll go to a meeting. And he took me out there, and he took my first AA meeting on the street. And there were some alcoholic cars at that meeting. And that was kind of the start of things for me. We went to Laramie and went to school. I got started in school and thought it'd be good. I'd probably have to find a job if I had left. And so I went through 4 years of college and 3 years in the summer. And I took a bachelor's degree in accounting that I used for maybe 9 months. And I hung on by the skin of my teeth in Laramie going to school. And the kids were growing up. Julia was working in Safeways, and I had taken a part-time job at a clothing store. And somebody else was talking about working. Was that you too, working in a clothing store? And I stole them blind when I did. And I'll tell you about that amends in a minute. Anyway, got through school, and I ended up in Denver. And all I had for me was 3 years and a few months of sobriety. I hadn't drank. I was untreated alcoholism, running around crazy. I was still so afraid to talk to you, eyeball to eyeball, that I couldn't look you in the eye. I just couldn't handle it. If we were talking, I was looking at my shoes, something in front of me. I just couldn't handle it. You could tell how afraid I was. I got down there, and I had a job with an oil company, and I started looking for AA meetings. And I was running into something in AA that I'd run into in Wyoming, and I don't know what I expected difference, but I'd get somebody come in and be well-meaning people that would pat me on the back and say, gee, Gary, isn't it great you got a hold of that thing so young and didn't have to go through everything we went through to get here? And I'm thinking, hell, I damn near died there. I don't think I could do what those guys did. I never would have made it. I picked up a buddy in that meeting, and we had gone to his house one night, one afternoon, and we're sitting there talking. Mostly we were belly aching about what we were learning in AA. He was really good at it. He could probably belly ache better than anybody I knew, and we were going to rewrite the first portion of the fifth chapter. It needed some pretty drastic changes. And Joe's wife said, you know, you two are the most two miserable men I've seen in a long time. And she says, and I'm sick of being around you. She says, get out of here. I don't care where you go. She says, why don't you go downtown to the Denver Young People's Group? They got a meeting down there in the storefront by the Denver Post. And my friend Joe says, come on, Brown, we'll go down there. He says, the babes there got to be better looking anyway. They were. Worked. But that's why we went. And that was the beginning of an adventure that, whether you know it or not, has continued out here with us. I went into that meeting, and I had been sober as long or longer than most other people in there. I was probably crowding 4 years. And Lee was right behind me. That was for Janice's benefit, but she was nodding her head because she knows most of these monkeys. And they talked about stuff I hadn't heard before. I'd been in AA for 3+ years, and nobody had talked a great deal about taking the steps. My only memory of step work being discussed before that in Laramie was when old Frank had been in and out a long time, and he's sitting there in a meeting, and he says, I'm sober longer than I've ever been in my life, and I got to tell you, what I did different was I took the third step, and I've been doing great. And the next Saturday, old Frank came down drunk, and I thought, I ain't screwing to that third step. I don't have any memories of any more than that around taking steps in 3+ years of AA. They might have said it. They very likely could have. I might have been thinking of something else. So we get to talking in that meeting about steps, and somebody talks about taking them in order, and I thought that was a novel idea. Well, what the hell? They're up there. Just reach up and grab one. You know, probably work just fine. And Lee said to me one time, he says, well, you can go ahead and do that, Gary, if you want to. And if you should live through that, you might want to try doing what we do. And they were trying to encourage me then to go on with what they were talking about, but I didn't get it. And a short time later, at that point in time, the Denver Young People's Group had two meetings a week. On Tuesdays, we met down in that storefront, and it was a closed discussion meeting. And at that point in time, young people's met under 40. Yeah, that's what I thought, too. The other meeting was an open discussion meeting that met at the York Street Club, which is kind of a notorious old AA club that's been there in Denver for many, many years. And we met up in the biggest room on the floor. It's the ballroom in an old mansion is what that club is. We met up there on Sunday nights. And it was a crazy meeting. It was wonderful. I mean, I think people would come to that meeting just to see who was going to come in next. And we normally had three speakers in an hour, and to come in there, you had to be capable of smoking 3 to 4 cigarettes in an hour. And it was wonderful, and we had more fun. And we decided one day to start another meeting, and we didn't have a place to hold it, but we had heard some stuff from some people out of Winnipeg, Canada, Manitoba, who had learned the thing about opening the big book and doing precisely what it says and getting through it. And for what it's worth, I don't know why I'm thinking this right now, the name of that group was the Golden Slippers Group. Yeah, you know the story. They called them that because these guys couldn't stay sober. That's what they did. They'd come in for a while and then they'd go back out and drink and come and drift in and out. And one of them disappeared for a while. And he went out someplace and some people took him through the steps. And we don't know who that was. We don't have a clue. When Mac got back, he shared this with the guys. And so they thought that was a great idea. So their meeting at that point, the Golden Slippers meeting at that point, turned into a meeting where they would do what we do in our workshops and saying they would go through the book and take the steps together while they were doing it. If a newcomer came to the meeting, they didn't change the subject of the meeting. Two or three of them would take the newcomer into another room and they would 12-step them and help them and try to get them initiated into AA somehow. And they wouldn't do that. The Golden Slippers quit slipping. It changed. It worked for them, and it changed. And we heard about that story from Mac, and his name was Mac Cheater. So we decided we were going to start another meeting of the Denver Young People's Group, and we were going to do that. And we didn't have to have a place to meet, so we decided to meet in homes. First home was in Lee's house. Lee lived on a place called Goat Hill. It's because of the goats. You kind of had to move them off the porch and watch where you stepped when you went in. I don't remember how many of us started there, but we really didn't know what to do, but we did. We were given the answers without a guru. There wasn't anybody there that had done it before. And so we opened the book at the beginning, again, a whole novel idea. We tried to figure out what the circle and triangle meant, and it doesn't mean anything anymore because it's not in your big books, but it meant a great deal to us. And if you want to know about it, I'll tell you sometime. And we went on, and we didn't have any rules. We had a reader, and that would change, and maybe some nights you'd have 2 or 3 readers that went on, but the rules were, there are no rules. If you got to interrupt this stuff at any time, feel free. And we did that. And generally, those who interrupted were pretty appropriate to what we were talking about in the book, except me. And I remember one time saying, well, the way I interpret that, they said, Gary, we don't much care how you interpret that. We're really more interested in the black print on the white page. I heard that a number of times. And I found out I was really an alcoholic there. I found out that I had known all along that I was powerless over alcohol. I really did understand that. I know that I can't not drink, and I know if I do drink, I certainly can't not drink. I can't stay away from that first drink, and if that's not powerlessness, I'll... Never mind. I understood that. And then we got to reading into the, we got through the doctor's opinion, and I got most of that because I related to that, because every time I took the drink, I had to drink. And we got into the third chapter, and the line in there that says we learned we had to fully concede our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first step to recovery. The delusion or anything like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. And I was given the keys to the kingdom then. I really was. I understood that anything I had been trying to manipulate in my life had failed. Period. And I don't know that I was even capable of really intellectually figuring all that out. But that was one of those deals that went on right here. By that point in time, I'd seen people come into AA who I knew were a great deal sicker than I. And they came in and changed. They came in and got well. They came in and the guys started picking up where they left off with their jobs, and they were getting caught up on their child support, and some of them were getting everything straightened out. And I'm looking at these people, and they were crazy. And they really were. And something was changing them. And they said it was God. And I like to tell that because that's how the second step happened to me. I don't remember consciously ever thinking about that. I was watching God get drunk sober in AA meeting. And he really was, because I saw him change. I saw him come in with nobody here. And after there was a while, something had moved in. And that's how I came to believe that, some way, somehow, God would restore me to sanity. I learned in there somehow that we were talking primarily alcoholic insanity, and that's this inability to stay away from the first drink, no matter what our experiences had told us, no matter what we knew. I think it goes beyond that. I mean, the second step promises some kind of wholeness somewhere, but it was talking to me primarily about the alcoholic insanity. One of my friends there, his name was Tom. And Tom was one of my favorite people. Still is. I haven't seen him in a year. I've heard he's in Texas. But Tom was just a real lunatic. We had more fun running around sober in AA. Most effective 12-stepper I ever saw. He made a 12-step call through bus windows on the city bus going to work one day. I'm not kidding, Tim. He pulls up in the bus. And he's looking out the window. And the bus next to him is his own drinking buddy, Art. He said, "Hey, Art, I got some neat shit going on at my house now. Come on over tonight." Got Art to his first meeting. He's still sober. He came into the meeting to us, and he was telling about the time he was going to get healed. He went to a treatment center where they did the aversion treatment. I know you know about the aversion treatment, don't you? And for those of you who don't, it's a medieval thing. That's kind of like a riptide. That ain't funny, Chad. Hospital setting. And a treatment room. And the treatment room is just a room. You know, picture a room maybe 12, 15 foot square. Mirrors on the walls, shelves attached to the mirrors, liquor sitting on the shelves, liquor bottles. Middle of the room, there's a barber chair with a stainless steel pot attached to one of the arms, and it would swivel. It would swivel in front of or away from who was sitting there. And they'd given Tom some antabus and sent him into the room for his treatment. They said, "Take your pick. Whatever you want to drink, Tom, have at it." And the whole idea was it is he drinks on top of the antabuse. He watches himself in the mirrors get violently ill. He watches his hair fall out, his eyes cross, his toenails curl. And when it's all over, he's going to be so adverse to it, he'll just never take another drink. I mean, that's the mission of the aversion treatment. And so when Tom came to us a few years later, he came to us and he said it had really worked. He said it really had. He hadn't had reason or excuse to take antabuse since. And and we got into the fifth chapter, and we're reading the bit about the actor, and we get on through it in this meeting. And by this time, the group had thinned down some. I don't know what happened to the girls. I know it wasn't me. But they had gone. And we're down to 14 men in there. And we had read this about the third step in there. And Lee again says, I have an idea. He says, I think we should all read/pray this third step prayer again. He says, maybe we ought to hold hands and do that. He said, the reason I would like to do that is I've been attending a bunch of meetings around Denver lately, and many of them have been, the subject have been on the fourth step, on inventory. And he says, after those meetings are over, I'll go ask some of these people why they haven't written an inventory yet. And many of them said because they hadn't taken a third step yet. And he says, I would like for us to all join hands and pray the third step prayer. Because in a couple weeks, if you hear me telling them I haven't started an inventory yet because I haven't taken a third step, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it. And that's the kind of logic that worked with us. And so what we did was just that. A little uncomfortable for me. I wasn't used to being in a room full of boys holding hands. And I really wasn't used to having somebody see me pray. My God. And so we did it. And probably in all truth, I did it because the rest of the guys were doing it. You know, I didn't want to be the oddball there. Hell, I already was. And but we did that, and we did it together. And sometime later, I said another prayer and asked God to make it real, that I really meant it. I was so tired of the pain and the stuff I'd been through at nearly 4 years sober, I couldn't stand it. But I love to tell that story because of that 14 men, we only lost one. Eddie went out and froze to death. And the rest of us made it. Of that 13 men, one of us became a trustee at large. You know who I'm talking about. And the rest of us have been very active in AA around the country, around Denver, doing things like we're talking about here. Some of us talking at conferences, but more importantly, much more importantly, some of us sitting down and saying, look, we kind of learned this thing about how our life has changed so dramatically. If somebody sits down and shows us how to go through this book and how to write an inventory. We stopped telling our pigeons to go write inventory. We sat down with them and showed them how. That's important. I'm 40 years sober. I'm 65 years old. There's a skinny Indian running around out here that's 47, 48 years sober. I don't remember. That came out of that group. The last I heard, he was living in Las Vegas. And not much older than I am, but a little bit. We've lost two or three of us now, but it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. And that's a powerful, powerful message that comes about from just sitting down and doing this deal the way that I really think is made up. We got into the fourth step, and pretty quickly right after that, we all had tangible evidence that we'd taken a third step. If you don't have a written inventory, you don't have evidence. Just thought you ought to know that. Uh, And I went home one night after a meeting because some things had changed at this meeting, and I sat down and I wrote an inventory and I did the best I could. Based on what I had at the time, we hadn't figured out this fourth column stuff yet, so we had to trust in God. And I went home and I did the best thing I could do, writing effectively a three-column inventory. And I shared it with a guy I didn't particularly like in the group, but he was the only one available at the time. And you met him at the thing. And we both changed as a result of that. And I got such profound relief from that first time I wrote an inventory and took a fifth step. I've written many inventories since then, and most of them better than that one. I got good at writing inventory. Big deal. That's the one that saved my old skinny butt. And and effectively, I had learned this thing. I'd got a great deal of relief. And in terms of progressing further in the steps, I delayed further work. We had so much fun in the young people's group in Denver. We'd gotten that far in the steps. Julie had been incredibly active in Al-Anon. And I had got into a business that was working pretty good. It was just a small business, but we fed 5-6 different families, and we did okay at it. And my partner in it was taken out because of a bout with cancer. And when she came back to it, she was very angry, even though I thought I'd done a pretty good job holding the business together. But she was upset because I'd spent a lot of money on the company credit cards for my personal use. She was kind of irritated. And so I got that all straightened out, and I did everything else I could to make it work, and it just wasn't working. I had become ineffective, and she didn't particularly seem to want me around. Didn't know what to do, and so Julie and I started praying. And we said a prayer this one night, and the next morning a phone rings. We're literally not out of bed yet. And a friend of mine, frankly, the guy that initially introduced me to the Denver Young People Group at that point was living in Nashville. And he called me and he says, "I've been in my quiet time this morning and I came over and I'm calling you. I'm not sure why." He says, "But I need somebody to come out here and work in my business in the Midwest." And Julie and I had prayed the light before, and if that wasn't an answer, it sure beat a bolt of lightning. And effectively, that's what got us to Indiana. And I thought this was really going to be the answer. I mean, our money problems were going to be over, and everything was going to be just great, and it's going to work out there. And we move out there, and it's weird out there. Indianapolis had 45 AA meetings a week, and most of them were speaker meetings. This was in 1977. And we'd come from from Denver, and I think at that point in time they had 300, 400, maybe 500 meetings and more. And it was crazy. It was all over town, and it was exciting, and people loved doing it. We'd go to Indianapolis, and that wasn't all that exciting. They didn't do that. Julie and I went to the first AA meeting there, and a guy that had driven us around to find houses and things when we were first moving out there was chairing the meeting. And I'll never forget, he gets up front and he says, "Hi, everybody, I'm Al, and I'm an alcoholic." And Julie and I are, "Hi, Al." And the whole damn group turns around and looks at us. They didn't say, "Hi, Al." By God, they do now, but they're not. Nobody knew anything about the big book. I looked and I looked and I would talk to the men. I'd look for the older guys that were around there and all that, and they weren't experienced with what we do. One guy out there, and he's still alive, and bless his heart, he says, "I've found the easier, softer way, and that's being a GSR and a district committeeman and doing all that." And that's been his program for 40 years. But I had tried that, and that didn't work any better than what we were doing. And so I was the new guy in town, and I was somewhat mouthy, and it wasn't long before I had probably talked at all 40 of those speaker meetings around the city. And I shared my experience up and through the fifth step and my brief looking at six and seven. And a guy came to me and called me one day, and he says, "Gary," he says, "I would like to start one of those groups." And I said, "Great, Larry, I'm glad of that. I'm really glad you're going." He says, "Well, you'll come, won't you?" I said, "Okay." And so we get there, and guess what? We had 14 men there. Lost one. I don't know what happened to him. He might be just fine somewhere. I don't know where he went. And we the rest of us completed with what we did with that. And we knew somehow, and I don't remember saying it, I might have, that this had to go on, and it did it. And so these guys kind of went out in twos and threes and gathered up another fistful of people and sat down with them and showed them how to do that. Flash forward now somewhat 25 years later, and my guess is in Indianapolis right now, I was telling Kenny there's probably 10 workshops going around right now, but thinking about that, there's probably more. Because people there have learned how to do it. And there's a lot of gurus around there. If you've met a couple of them, but they were here last year. But it just goes on. It goes on with women's groups and co-ed groups and Al-Anon and what it is just from carrying the message. Now, I wouldn't mind making some money during that time, but apparently God didn't have that in mind at that point in time. During that time, I was making some money here and there, but I was living in such a period of dishonesty, and I was living in a period of infidelity, and I was living in a period of just stupidity, I guess, as I get with that. And I'd come to a point in time where I'm learning a horrible lesson. And it won't save any time for some of you going to do what I'm going to do, but just in case that it might, I'd like you to understand something. If you're a person in this fellowship who would really like to succeed at this thing and you really want to live a spiritual life, then don't do anything dishonest in any part of your life. Because I lied about my sexual life, and it screwed up my financial life and my social life. It just does. If I lie anywhere about one thing, it's going to affect everything everywhere in my life. Just give it a little time, I promise you. And I learned that lesson with that. And I got to the point at 20 years sobriety where we were going to lose a house. And a friend in AA came down from Minnesota and bailed us out. I guess I got time to tell that story quickly. I've been bouncing around AA and doing a little talking here and there and become a friend with this guy up there in the Twin Cities. And we really like each other. We still like each other a lot. We don't see each other much, but we had a good time. And he called us one day and said, "I got to give a talk," and I think it was Virginia. And I got some time on my hand. I thought I would stop off in Indianapolis and see you and Julie before I go on. And so he does that. When I meet him at the airport, we stop for a cup of coffee to talk, and he looks me in the eye, and he sees there's nobody home, and he said, "What's going on?" And I said, "I'm in real trouble. I'm in real trouble." I says, "They're going to foreclose on the house tomorrow morning, and it's going to kill Julie. She doesn't know. I've never told her." I hadn't even told my best friend in AA. I told you about Earl this afternoon, and I hadn't even told him about it. And I didn't know what to do. And so we get in the car and we're driving. Interstate 70 goes right through the middle of Indianapolis. And Bob says to me, he said, "Where's your bank? Where's the bank?" And I said, "What bank?" He says, "The one that has the note on your house." And I said, "Well, it's right downtown here." And he says, "Really?" He said, let's go down and have a talk with them. I said, Bob, they're real tired of talking. They've had a whole load of talk, and they don't. He said, let's go anyway. So we go down there, and I park across the street from the bank. And I'll never forget it. I can still, in my mind, picture Bob and I walking across the street to go in that bank. Did you ever walk in to see the principal with your dad, Tim? That kind of what it felt like. And that talk went like this. We sit down there, and this guy comes out. He's got one of them wrinkles that goes right down here. And Bob says to him, how much does it take to get Gary bailed out here? And he gives him a big number because, you know, they're pretty tolerant with that kind of stuff. And I was behind a boatload of house payment. And Bob reached in his pocket, and he peeled off a bunch of traveler's checks and a bunch of cash. And he plunks it down there, and we walk out of there, and we're even. And he hands me the receipt. And we're walking back across that street, and I said, shit, Bob, I got to pay that back. He said, that's your problem. I'm not sure he knew the importance of that crack, but he was sure right. Shortly after that, I was 20 years sober at that point. Shortly after that, I'm in so much trouble that I called a man in Chicago that I'd known for a long time. I'd had another man as a sponsor for some years up before that who had died. And so I called Paul up in Chicago, and my opening question was, Paul, do you think that a 40-year-old alcoholic with 20 years of sobriety could be going, a grandfather, 40-year-old alcoholic grandfather with 20 years of sobriety could be going through male menopause? And he said, well, maybe. He says, why don't you write another inventory and come up here and take some fifth steps, swap it some fifth steps, whatever it's worth, and that'll be a start to it. And I said, Paul, I'll do anything I have to do. I was precisely where I was, only I think it was worse than where I was that first time I wrote an inventory. The pain was that bad. I'd have done anything. And so I went and I wrote an inventory, and it was a good one. I had the resentment inventory was all current stuff. It wasn't old resentments. And I like to tell you that because I'm perfectly capable of causing a great deal more harm stone sober than I ever did drunk. I don't think that's true with you, but. And the fear list was phenomenal. I rewrote my conduct inventory, and I went back through my life again as far as I could remember and everybody that was involved. And I called Paul, and I said, I'm ready. He says, good. He says, be up here by 5 o'clock Friday. Told me a motel to be at down in LaGrange. And I'm there. I'm there at 4:45 Friday. And I got time to go get a cup of coffee, and I get back to my room, and I sit down, and there's a knock on the door. I open the door, and there's a stone stranger there. He tells me his name is Dennis O'Brien. He's dead now. He says, I'm 29 years sober, and I'm here to swap fifth steps with you. He says, I'll go first so you know what to do. And he sits down. He opens a three-ring binder, and he starts reading inventory to me. There was some really familiar stuff in that inventory, and it was his inventory, but it was a lot like mine. And then when he was done, I read him mine, and then we compared notes. I'd picked up some stuff that he'd missed, and he'd picked up some things that I'd missed. And we got up and left, and I went and got a cup of coffee and come back, and Chuck's there. Chuck's 23 years sober. He's there to swap fifth steps with me, and he's going to go first, so I'll know what to do. Noon Sunday, I'd done that 9 times. And I'd done it with people at that time. Paul would have been about 35 years sober. And he's 58 now, as of this last Monday, wasn't he? And We're finished. We go to lunch, and I'm sitting there with the guys, and one of them said, I think it was Paul, said, get out your pencil and paper. I'll help you with your amends list. They had some remarkable memories, Luther. It was unbelievable. So we start my amends list. And Paul said, do you have any amends of people you don't, to people you don't resent or longer? And I said, oh yeah, I got a lot of them. You see, we owed a great deal of money. And money we had taken under any number of pretenses from people that were never going to send us a bill. We owed it to our parents, we owed it to friends in AA, not just Bob, and we owed it to all these people. And so they had me write all of them down. Had me estimate how much money it was and work it out. And they said, how in the hell did you stay sober all these years without taking care of all that garbage? And it just had to be the grace of God, period. And it was. And I got to tell you, it wasn't any picnic. Sure as hell, somebody's going to come up to me after I talk like that and say, boy, I'm glad to hear you were able to make it 20 years without making your amends. That's not the idea, kids. Please don't do what I did. So, would you give me a couple shots of that, please? A double? thank you. I come home from that, and I sit down with Julie, and we go through the amends together. And she fully agrees that they're her amends as well as mine, because she had been with us when we did that. We had signed notes with her, a note with her parents that we'd pay it back. It was really important to them to have a signed note. It didn't mean anything to me, but it taught a lot to them. and so these are all part of the deal and all that. So we start the process. One of those was to the guy that owned the clothing store when we were going to school in Laramie. He had trusted me with that store. I was older than the other students while we were working there, and so if he was gone, he put me in charge of running the store, and I paid him back by taking anything out the back door I thought I could get away with. I left the University of Wyoming as probably the best-dressed graduating senior they'd ever seen, but I'd stolen all the clothes. And I had to track John down. He had retired and sold the store, and I finally found him, and the call went something like this. John, this is Gary Brown. Do you remember me? And he said, yeah, you used to work for me. He said, are you still going to those meetings? And I said, yeah, that's why I'm calling. Because I'm going to probably die if I don't straighten some of this stuff up. And I told him how much money and clothing I'd stolen from him and that. He's dead silent. He says, you know, I thought you were stealing that shit. We made a deal to start paying him back. I was going to give him some kind of token payment every month to do it. I went along for a few months, and I did it fine. Then I missed the commission check, and he didn't get paid, and he called me and asked for his money. And I said, John, I got to pay you back. I have every intention of doing that. I just missed a commission check and the money wasn't there. He says, you got to pay everybody else back. I don't need the money. I'm retired. I'm fine. I don't need it. But you got to promise me you'll pay everybody else. And I said, okay, I would. And, you know, so he forgave me the debt. We called some other people. We called Julie's folks. This is an important one. I called the house, and her dad answered the phone. And he says, I tell him I'm calling. And what I told him, I says, Ellis, is you have treated me with nothing but kindness and tolerance and patience all the years you've known me. I said, I know the pain I caused you with the way I treated Julie and the way I treated the girls. I know it drove you nuts because I know the kind of man you are. And I'm really grateful, and I love you, he said, oh, shit, and he gave the phone to Grandma. And And so I go through the same thing with Julie's mother. And I said, by the way, have you any idea how much money you've given us over the years? And she says, right down to the last penny. And so we made a deal to start paying her back. And time goes by, and we're chipping away. I had an 18-column columnar pad that I'm figuring all these things out and keeping track of them on. And I would go home on a payday, and I'd write down who I could pay and all that. I'd leave just a little bit of money out for gas and groceries and if the kids needed something for school. And then we were broke till next payday. And I went down there this one time, and I told Julian, I says, I'm never going to make enough money to do this. It's just never going to happen. And I don't know what the hell we're going to do about it. And I was really feeling sorry for myself. And I don't remember what she said at the time. I got a hunch what she said under her breath, but I didn't hear anything. And the next morning we get up to go to work, and she says, I have an idea. She said, you've been working at the same job here for quite a while. You've built up some money in your retirement in that 401k thing. We've lived at the same house for a number of years. She said, we have equity in the home. She says, I think we could sell the house, cash in your retirement, pay off all the amends and some of the current debt, and maybe there'd be enough left where we could buy a used mobile home or something. Yeah, used trailer was the word. And I walked out the door going to work thinking, oh, I hope she's not serious. She can't be serious. I go home that night, and I know she's serious, and my last hope is my sponsor will bail me out, and I said, let's call Paul. And so I tell him, I said, I've said some local stuff to use over the years, but try this on, and so I take him through the whole thing, you know, we're going to sell the house and cash in the 401k and all. I says, how crazy does that sound? He says, Gary, he says, in the 20-plus years I've known you, that's the sanest thing I've ever heard you say. He said, was it your idea? And I said, no, it was Julie's, and he said he thought so. We listed the house for sale. Made that call in September. The house sold on the 28th of February, and I remember that date because Julie was having her 39th birthday again. That was the greatest day of our lives. It truly was. It went something like this, and just real quickly. We did exactly that. We sold the house. We bought a used mobile home, and I get on the phone, and I call Bob in St. Paul, and I said, what's your address? I got the money to pay you now. And he laughed. And I said, what's so damn funny? And he said, well, cowboys like this. Back when that happened, and I gave you that money, I was making so much money, I couldn't spend it. He had a business that generated just all the cash in the world. And he said that recently Congress had passed a law and he couldn't take advantage of the limited partnerships and the depreciation that's involved in all that. And he had all these apartment houses around the country that only generated rents. And he had investors that were after him for the money. And he was on an allowance for the first time in his life. And he says, I really haven't complained about that. He says, Linda and I used to pray about our tithe and who we were going to tithe to. He said, we could only give so much to the church. I was making so much. And so I helped you and many other AAs around the country out with their situation. And he says, these last few weeks, every once in a while, I'm going down to the mailbox and I'm getting the mail and there's a check in there. So I'd become a part of a really big deal. And I had tangible proof of it. I'm not so sure I fully believed how big a deal this is. Until then. So anyway, I got him paid off. Called John and Laramie. I said, what's your address? I got the money to pay, and he gave me the address. He forgot he forgave me. And I sent him a check, and we paid Julie's parents off, and we got all that, and our lives changed substantially. All the promises we've been shooting our mouth off for years were beginning to happen, really. And it did. We now are two houses since the trailer, and things have changed for us, and things are going pretty well. I want to talk about family for a minute before I sit down. 1992, Mickey M. was in Indianapolis. And he was at our house after talking at a convention. He and Mike and some of the other people from there in Indiana are sitting. We were in the trailer. We're still in the mobile home. And we were sitting there talking about this thing that we do here, this creating this fellowship of the Spirit that we hadn't called it then. And we thought, wouldn't it be a great to figure out a way to have a reunion of all of us? We're all over the country now. We're still a minority in AA, but we are. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful to do that? And we made a decision that we were going to start a convention, and Mickey was going to do it somewhere in Colorado. And it was going to happen. And he did, and he got Don involved and all of that. So the Fellowship of the Spirit thing started at Breckenridge. And I met some of you at Breckenridge, and I think that was 1993. At that point, right, David? And so now we're at the Fellowship of the Spirit in Northwest here. And I've been to one in New York last August. Going to one in Virginia this May or June. And it took off from a bunch of drunks who wanted to hang out with family. And I just like to bring that because you're in the midst of a family that has happened. We caught Clint in a hotel room in Nashville at the Music City Roundup, and we cornered him in a in a hotel room up there, and we caught him at a time, and he was a man we'd always respected in AA. And Don and I and a couple others of us explained to him what we do, and he wanted a part of it. And he's been a huge mover of the Fellowship of the Spirit, just a monster. Meantime, our family was going on. Julie and I and the three girls I told you about. Carrie, the oldest one, went out, and they each had five children. They had a total of five grandchildren. The oldest one is out there right now in serious trouble with booze and crack and diabetes, and he's going to be lucky to make it to 30, and he's 24 today. I guess the next oldest is a couple of years younger than him and just got out of the Navy, and he's entering Indiana University, going to study something besides girls, I think. He's just a great kid. He's one of those Hispanic kids that's really got his gear together, Magdalena. He came to me when he got out of high school, and he says, "Grandpa, I'm not mature enough to go to college now. I think I better join the Navy." I thought, God, I wish I'd have been that mature at 18. The next one is our only granddaughter, and she's in college, and she's going to be a teacher. And the next one is also in college, and he's probably going to be a teacher. The science courses are killing him. And the youngest one just graduated from high school and just joined the Marines. We're really proud of him. That oldest one I told you about went out, and he knocked up a 16-year-old girl 5 years ago. And this is a Jerry Springer story, so be ready. I really got to think this through to tell it. Their daughter was born. Her name is Haley. And now she's 4 years old, going on five. And then, about 18 months later, Emily was born. And different father. Another dog going through the neighborhood. And when Emily is 2 weeks old, the mother gets stopped by the police, and the kids are riding in the car, laying on the seats. They're not in, I guess they were taken to our daughter, Patty, the oldest one's mother, because they weren't in safety seats, and they didn't want them like that. And they've never left our daughter's house since then. Like I say, Haley is 4 and Emmy will be 3 in November. We have been praying so much. These two children have been thriving in our daughter's and our son-in-law's care. We were always watching the insanity of the courts with the visitation with the mother and multiple fathers and all this stuff going on. And we were so terrified because we know that their only goal is to put children back with their parents, because that's what makes their statistics look good. It doesn't do much for the babies, but what the hell, they don't vote. So we've really been kind of concerned about this. But our three daughters, and the four, all five of the grandchildren, though Tim's not allowed to be around them, these little girls are a family. Julie and I are going to be grandma and grandpa again. We're not going to be great-grandma and grandpa because the adoption is going to happen. And Patty's going to get the kids. And Shannon talked a little bit that we've been married in AA and all this stuff and everything that could have gone wrong. And given my head, probably would have gone wrong had not God found a way to interfere. These little girls would be just out there. And they'd be in some serious trouble. I don't think we'd all be sitting in here in the Fellowship of the Spirit Northwest if God had put them together with 13 guys that came out of a crazy meeting on Goat Hill. And they changed it. I just think it's a wonderful story. And I can't figure out why I got to be a part of it. Don never figured it out. But we were given this thing for us all. And I hope you are as in love with this program and as in love with each other as I am. Thanks for having me here.